Okay, so holography factor fiction, it sounds like a good question. And the floor is open for answers. Maybe I should stand down here. So, okay, if nobody will say anything, I'll start by writing a few questions, like sub-questions or ways of asking that question. So, is ADS CFT convincingly demonstrated? Whoops. So is holography a consequence of diffeomorphism and variance alone? Or do we need something special? Like, this first came out of string theory. It generally seems to be believed today that that was just kind of the lucky context where it was discovered, but isn't necessarily underlying the idea of holography. So is holography a consequence of diff invariance alone? And I guess a sort of subversion of that is this concept that Don Maroff introduced of boundary unitarity. Maroff's argument of boundary unitarity. A couple of more things. So the context that's best developed has a boundary at the has an asymptotically anti-de Sitter spacetime. The dual field theory is in some sense located, can be thought of as located there. But can the idea of holography be made much more local? Does it really depend on having asymptotic anti-de Sitter? Could it be done with no boundary at all? So to just summarize that question, I'll say, can holography, or is, yeah, can holography be, or is holography, let's call it quasi-local? So in other words, like regional holography. And another thing is, in the context of the best developed version of this holography, the ADS is shorthand for a gravitating theory with maybe other fields, maybe actually UV completion to string theory, but it includes gravity, whereas the CFT is just an ordinary quantum field theory on a fixed geometry with no gravity. So it looks like we have gravity without gravity. And is that really, so that's a fundamental aspect of this whole thing. In terms of the problem of quantum gravity, that's extremely important concept. Like, if we're so vexed and confused by trying to quantize gravity, if we could just trade a gravitational theory for one without gravity, that seems like a pretty big advantage. So is that really a viable route? Can we believe the idea that we might get gravity without gravity? And I think I had one more. Yeah, let's just say the issue, it's actually related to this one, of no local observables, absence of local observables in a diff invariant theory. So the idea there is just like, well, if it's really true that, you know, whatever we, however we manage to understand quantum gravity, it will have the feature that there are no local observables. Does that already tell us that there's something necessarily holographic about gravity? So this is the best I could do to come up with a quick, short list of trigger questions. And I'm all ears. Carlo.
I want to throw some consideration here, start reacting on that. Each one of these, it's a subtle technical issue, which I don't think it's it can be discussed in this. So I'm just telling what I think about this and what the community thinks about that. I looked at Marrow's argument about the unitarity, and I do not find it convincing because it mixes what in old gravitational theory was called the multi-fingered evolution, so evolution in which you start from a certain Cauchy surfaces and evolve only locally, and evolution at infinity. The two things are actually only related to one gauge fixes and chooses a preferred. And I think that Marrow's regard thinks that one can observe infinity, assumes that thing that app contain everything, and that's just wrong, it seems to me.
Sorry, I just want to make sure I understood what you just said. Did you simply say that not all observables are can be measured at infinity? So you think that boundary unitarity is just missing a part of the story of quantum gravity, or is it some other objection?
It's missing most of the story of quantum gravity. In the following sense, let me a bit better. I think that once we have a quantum theory of gravity, it should make sense only also if space is compact, has no mm-hmm. boundary. And generativity tell us that we can make local observations, of course not in the sense that depend on x and t, but in the sense that involve just a finite region of space-time. We can make observation within the solar system and make a full generativistic evolution of the solar system without getting out and seeing it from asymptotic surface. And I think that quantum gravity should be formulated, could be formulated in this way. I have never seen an argument contrary to that. Every time I get into a discussion about these things, it's a long discussion which, at the end, that's my experience, only ends to the point in which, yes, but we have seen in ADF CFD that it's so beautiful that you can define something that is capable. So, in other words, I respect the research program, of course. But it seems to me the research problem is based on some assumptions. And that is assumption, I thought my work is not a single word, has become a dogma. So people take it as a dogma, and there's a long list of consequences that follows. But there's always a dogma at the beginning, which might be right, might be wrong, and I think I would bet that it's been wrong.
So I just want to make one quick comment about that. I don't think boundary unitarity asserts the opposite of this. It just says that those observables that are measurable at the boundary evolve unitarily. So that could be consistent with what you're saying. You're just saying, fine, but there are lots of other observables I'm interested in that are not included there. Is that a valid way to summarize what you're saying?
No, because I would say that the majority of the interesting observables are the ones which I can look for.
Yeah, I think that's what I just said. I think that's consistent with what I just said.
Okay.
So I've understood your point.
Sorry, I have Matt. No idea what you guys are talking about. Can you just say in one sentence what Marolf's argument of boundary unitarity is so I can understand this?
Oh, sorry.
I'm sorry. Well, that's... so he argued in one sentence that since the Hamiltonian of a diffeomorphism invariant theory is a boundary term, any observable located at the boundary has a time evolution that takes it into another observable located at the boundary, and therefore the full algebra of all boundary observables evolves into itself unitarily, and therefore no information that was available at the boundary at one time. Let me put it positively. Any information that was available at the boundary at one time is available at the boundary at all times. It doesn't assert that all information is available at the boundary, but anything that was evolves unitarily. Now, that's a very glib summary of the argument. I think it's deeper than that, but it's also questionable. The key issue I think that you can question it on is this concept of an algebra of boundary observables that's closed under itself really a valid concept? Is it sustainable for finite time evolution? So that would be a potential weak part of it, but I think it's a pretty compelling argument. But it doesn't contradict, I think, Carlo's viewpoint. Robert.
Yes, I'd like to actually support what Carlo said. So concerning the last point that you wrote down, I hear that statement very often, that in the diffeomorphism invariant theory, there are no local observables. But let me propose a local observable. The Hubble expansion rate at a point in space-time where a particular matter field has a particular value. That's an observable which is of great interest in cosmology. So am I making a mistake in proposing this as a nice observable? So it's related to the issue of relational clock. So I'm essentially proposing.
So there's certainly a serious issue with. First of all, there's a paper exploring exactly. Well, several people have explored this idea, but there's one I know of by Maroff and Hartle and Steve Giddings. You were pointing to yourself. You also.
Well, we have lots of work with this observable.
There's lots of people.
But the thing is, if you say a scalar field, the problem is, if you're thinking of a particular setting where you have a macroscopic, steady vacuum expectation value of a scalar, and then small fluctuations on top of it, and you're only referring to the average value, first of all, it's not an observable if it's defined in terms of an average value. And in a general state, that scalar field doesn't have an average value. And if you look at the actual values locally of the field, they're fluctuating in the vacuum by a huge amount.
Well,
so it's actually quite difficult. I don't think that's actually a well-defined observable in the quantum
let's
gravity.
Ask the question at the purely classical level. Classical observable.
Well, classically, because we have one world, we can always make observables related to, like, you know, 1 centimeter from the end of this hockey stick, you know, what's the color of the paint? That's an observable, but it refers to a state of the room we're in and the existence of the hockey stick and everything. So that's not on the table when we're trying to define observables, I think, in quantum gravity in a way that's valid before we specify the state.
Okay, so the problem that you wrote down is a problem at the quantum level.
Yeah.
Sometimes the version of the argument starts with the classical issue on Poisson brackets. And there, I think it doesn't look correct to me. And I think the same mistake also might be carrying on to the quantum domain. At the classical level, sometimes people also say the Hamiltonian gravity is a boundary term.
It is.
But that the value of the Hamiltonian evaluated on a solution is a boundary term because it's a total derivative. But we don't want the value of the Hamiltonian. We want to take Poisson brackets with it to find something that evolves,
right?
The variation of the Hamiltonian.
Yeah.
And then it's not a boundary term, because if I take a slicing of space like this and I want to just evolve to a local bump here in a very field of time, I can just evolve a scalar field from here to here without changing anything at the boundary. And once I gauge fix, let's try to gauge fix just 1 plus 1d gravity, but I can write built on gravity, but I can write the whole Hamiltonian, the evolution to a local bump variable in the interior is not something that you can catch.
Yeah, I don't think that argument gets. Yeah, it's certainly true that this boundary unitarity doesn't hold classically. There are explicit counterexamples. But so where does it fail? Like, what's the difference between classical and quantum in that respect? So one thing is that an observable that we're referring to that evolves, well, that Don was referring to that evolves unitarily, commutes with the constraints. So even if the Hamiltonian is an integral of constraints plus a boundary term, the constraints part doesn't, it commutes with the observable by definition, and therefore it only matters what the boundary term is. But there's still a little puzzle, because if it's clear classically that information is not conserved at the boundary classically, what's the difference between classical and quantum? And I wrote a paper with Fuch Wen proposing that the key difference is a kind of analyticity that quantum theory has that classical theory doesn't. Basically, that you can't Hamilton's equation for the time evolution of an observable, you have to integrate it to get the finite time evolution, and that can be, because you can have non-analytic data classically, it can be the case that the actual solution to it is not given by just the exponential series that you had written down that looks like the quantum evolution. So I think the fact that quantum observables evolved by conjugation by the unitary evolution operator is really a special property of quantum mechanics that doesn't exist in classical mechanics. That's my interpretation of why it doesn't, why there's such a strong difference between classical and quantum. It's a pretty touchy point, but I think it's, we did address it. But I don't want to stand here defending my viewpoint. I like, it's much more important is to hear other people's viewpoints.
Yeah, I'm still waiting for those controversial questions from the young people who they're too taboo to say more.
Yes.
So I have a question. I don't know a lot about this, so but so from the last talk we heard, you said that if the quantum field theory is finite in the infrared, then we don't have a singularity. But I didn't understand, or I don't know if you said, does it tell us what we have instead? So even if holography is correct, and if even if we can say, okay, we don't have a singularity, does it really tell us anything about the fundamental quantum gravity theory? And can we, like, is it, so, yeah.
So the point is it does. So the idea is if you want to describe this non-geometric phase, you know, quantum gravity phase at very early times, this is described holographically in terms of the physics of this 3D quantum field theory. And the point is this strong gravity phase is described by a weakly interacting quantum field theory. And that's the regime under which we have it under control. We do finite Dirac's perturbation theory. So we can compute all QFT, you know, we compute quantum field theory observables in perturbation theory just by finite diagrams. And that was how we were making predictions with microwave background, by doing quantum field theory calculations that we
calculate. Yeah, I understand
so
that, but
predictive in that sense.
I understand that, but I meant more in the sense of so, for example, is there a fundamental space? Is space discrete? Do we have networks? Like, those types of things that are where quantum gravity theories do not agree with each other. Could holography say, okay, I don't know, loop quantum gravity is correct, or no, it's not correct, or something like that, or...
Yeah, I mean, at present, in some sense, this is set up in the framework of string theory, and what we mean by the gravity becoming non-geometric is we're basically going back to the sort of string theory signal model description. It's something that's not really calculable or well understood, and that's why holography is valuable, because it allows us to work with a dual quantum field theory, which is perturbative in this regime. But yes, that's right. So all this is sort of set up in the framework of string theory, but it's really not, with a big caveat that it's very difficult to understand space types like de Sitter. It's very difficult to find an embedding of de Sitter space in string theory. So all the discussion today was based on the idea of mapping from cosmologies to space-times where holography is well understood to the name warp space-times. So I'm taking sort of standard holographic dictionary, but then I'm doing this mapping to cosmologies by analytic continuation. So this is an extension. This isn't on a secure footing as standard in the city of holography. This is a bottom-up approach to try and apply holography to cosmology. We'd like this to be standard holography is sort of very well understood. It comes from string theory. You get microscopic description from sort of top-down string theory constructions. We don't understand how to do this for cosmology. So what we're trying to do is a sort of bottom-up approach by analytically continuing from space science where holography is well understood in string theory. But how to interpret this cosmological description within string theory, it isn't something that's understood right now.
So the main goal is to, like you said, make predictions and confirm with observations and not to understand the fundamental reality of space or time.
Oh, we would love to do that. It's simply the difficult problem.
Yeah.
So I suppose in some sense, a starting point is you've got this bottom-up approach to try and understand holography for cosmology, starting from where holography is well understood in string theory. You know, what can you do with this? Well, one thing you'd like to do is try and test whether this picture has any merit whatsoever. So that's why we started trying to compute what you would see in the CMB. That fits, so that's encouraging. It's not, it doesn't really... We still have to address these deeper problems, and how do you think about this from a microscopic point of view? Can you really sort of bring this within string theory in a better light? In some sense, this is a somewhat phenomenological bottom-up attempt to try and understand cosmology in holographic language using as much as possible as we can about understanding standard holography from string theory. But yes, we would love to get to sort of more deeper questions as time goes on. So this was the sort of a first step.
We had a question here.
Yeah, I'm just kind of building off this question and off of Chris's talk. So this last question suggested that this sort of holography is like a useful calculational tool, and the really fundamentally the like quantum gravity picture that's dual to the conformal field theory is what's fundamental. But if there really is this sort of holographic principle, there's like a strict duality here. Do we have what sort of grounds do we have to say that one is more fundamental than the other? Like the really the world is, you know, string theory in n dimensions and not a conformal field theory in whatever other dimensions. And this isn't necessarily a question directly for you, just kind of a...
No, I have to answer it. I mean, in some sense, that's right. So it's a dual description. It's two different physical systems. One's a gravitational theory in deepless one dimensions, and one's a quantum field theory without gravity that lives in one dimension less. So they're equivalent descriptions of the same physics. So I can think about physics either from a gravitational theory point of view or from a quantum field theory point of view. They're dual to each other, so they're sort of on equivalent status. The difference really just crops up to do with the idea that it's a strongly coupling duality. So when one theory is strongly interacting, the other is weakly interacting. And in physics, basically from a calculational point of view, all our best calculational tools, such as Feynman diagrams, they operate at weakly interacting through perturbation theory. So the idea is which description you use, the quantum field theory or the gravity, is based on which it's sort of weakly interacting and hence calculable. So standard inflationary cosmology, you know, Einstein gravity holds, you've got small fluctuations around some space-time background that's, say, closer to sitter space. So, but that picture, it's very difficult to calculate the quantum field theory because it's some strongly interacting quantum field theory. You can get quite a long way using something called conformal perturbation theory. In fact, you get all the slow roll predictions out from the quantum field theory point of view using techniques from conformal perturbation theory. But the picture I was talking about is trying to extrapolate things to the opposite regime, where the gravity description is completely intractable. It's a strongly interacting non-geometric picture. And the proposal is to try and compute for that, extract predictions for realistic cosmologies by doing calculations in the quantum field theory, which is weakly interacting and hence under control. So both descriptions of gravity and the dual quantum field theory are sort of on equal footing, but which one you use is a calculational question, which one you have control over. That depends on the coupling.
I guess, so just to follow up, the more philosophical question of, you know, what the fundamental theory says about space-time. If we have these dualities and, you know, it's exact, and yes, we can use one for calculational convenience, but the other breaks down, whatever. It tells us that space-time is, or like space is somehow both d-dimensional and d.
Yes, space-time is emergent, if you like. You know, Locke says that one of the macroscopic dimensions of space-time emerges from the physics of a strongly interacting quantum field theory. So perhaps space-time isn't a fundamental description. Something emerges from the physics of some strongly interacting quantum field theory which has no gravity and is missing one of the dimensions.
But if you have an equivalence, the emergence is supposed to be an asymmetric relation and equivalence isn't.
why won't it be? In some sense, it's a mapping from one to the other. Observables in one, I can map to.
Well, then, which side do you say is emerging out of which, if it's a complete equivalence?
I suppose what I'm saying is that, I'm saying the extra radial, so in standard philosophy, you've got a radial direction that's emerging from the physics of this bounding quantum field theory, that's one dimension left. So one of the macroscopic dimensions is, so in some sense, you know, if I could compute in this quantum field theory, it could be certain observables, but those observables could also be calculated from a purely geometrical gravity calculation of space-time, which has one extra dimension. So there's a sort of hidden geometrical gravitational description of the physics of this strongly interacting quantum field theory. But the emergent thing is, in some sense, the extra dimension of space-time.
I guess what you're getting at, I think, is whether, is it really a duality where both descriptions in themselves are complete? Or is it that actually on one side there isn't even a way to talk about everything and you have to basically rely on the other side to define what you're talking about if you're trying to make all statements and with all accuracy? I don't think it's known, but it's a good question. I mean, certainly in the string theory context, I think the viewpoint of string theory, you know, like where this came from, it would be that there is in principle a complete description. It may be that in that description, what we normally think of as space-time, you know, is not a key, is not a stable element, but we have an we have a substitute for it on the string side. But if you ask, what is that substitute? Let's hear about it. You know, that people will say, well, we don't really understand string theory well enough yet to answer that. But it's at least a coherent viewpoint. But whether it's true or not, I don't think people know. Wait a second, there was a question in the back from a younger member.
Yeah, I have a question, but it's sort of a new question. So if that, I saw Robert has his hand up as well. So if you want to follow up on that, maybe you can ask after. So I'm also very ignorant about ADS, CFT, and taking a few courses, but I lack the fundamentals, I guess. And so I'd like to know, because I whenever I hear about ADS, CFT, I sort of go with the mathematical development and I follow it, and then I always fall back into thinking, well, how does this relate to the sitter cosmology and not anti the sitter. So how is ADS CFT relatable to the cosmology that we observe, which is the sitter? And like, how do they fit?
Yeah.
And also just another thing is like, is the idea just to develop the tools and the understanding until string theory manages to work with the sitter as well? And then that'll naturally translate into a DS CFT as well, or some, I have no idea. So.
Yeah, great questions. I mean, in some sense, I don't want to wait. I'd rather progress bottom-up based on what we understand right now. I mean, I'd love, yes, eventually let's hope string theory can understand the sitter space, and then we'll understand this at a much better level. But yeah, what your first question is really our starting point. You know, we've got this relatively well-understood understanding of holography and asymptotic anti-sitter space-time. It's very precise correspondence by now. There's lots of sort of checks. You know, how does that relate? You know, can we use these lessons we've learned to learn about real-world cosmology where the space-time isn't asymptotically anti-de-sitter? So, you know, in some sense, that was our starting point. How can we try and use the standard holographic dictionary to try and understand cosmological space-times? How do you make progress? We don't have a top-down approach from string theory to help us. So let's progress from the bottom up. There's a one-to-one mapping between domain wall space-types where we understand holography from AD and CFT, and cosmologies, and a space around just actively continuing perturbations, essentially the sign of the lattice is changing. So if you give me a solution of fluctuations about some asymptotic anti-de-sitter space-time, we can immediately construct a corresponding solution of fluctuations around some asymptotic de-sitter space-time. So there's a one-to-one mapping between these space-times, both the background of the perturbations to all room perturbation theory. I've checked explicitly up to the second order Gaussian invariant perturbation theory. So the idea is that because you've got a mapping between cosmologies and domain wall space-times where ADS-CFT is better understood, you want to use that mapping plus the standard ADS-CFT holographic dictionary to infer a dictionary for cosmology that relates physics of some quantum field theory to observables in some cosmological space-time. So that was the mapping I was discussing in the talk. And then how do you test this? What can you do with this? What's it good for? One answer is that it allows you to probe a new regime in which the gravity description is non-geometric. And you approach that because of the fact that quantum field theory is weakly coupled in this regime, and if you do calculations on the quantum field theory side alone. This is just one possibility. You can also have standard inflation, which corresponds to this quantum field theory being strongly interacted at all times, and there you can describe it using conformal perturbation theory methods. And I can recover all the standard predictions of slow roll inflation by these conformal field theory techniques.
I see.
But yes, that's precisely sort of what we were trying to do. In other words, how can you connect real-world cosmology to all this wonderful physics we've learned about holography and asymptotic ADS space-times.
So it's almost like the A is in brackets?
Yes, that's right. Ultimately, we'd like to use the lessons of holography to try and understand real cosmology. It's a very difficult question. We're trying to track it in the most obvious way, which is just by a bottom-up mapping of the domain walls to cosmologies. And in the longer term, we'd love it if there's some deeper understanding of string theory. That's a difficult thing, having embeddings of the sitter space in string theory.
Before you, I think was Chris wanted to respond.
So this might be an intractable question, but ADS is bizarre. It's non-globally hyperbolic, has all kinds of weird features. Which of those features are essential for the ADS-CFT correspondence, and what are the obstacles to coming up with a dictionary for other, either conformally flat or just other space times. I mean, as I said, that might be a bigger question than I realize, but.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes our best understanding our situation where we have a sort of top-down construction from spin theory. So spin theory, you can kind of, there's these non-perturbative objects called brains, you can stack them together, and then there's a sort of limit you can take in which you can think of as gravitational space-time as being a sort of metric that that's got the ABS, and we have an equivalent description, the same physics, in terms of gauge theory, quantum field theory. The sort of top-down construction from spin theory that gives you both sides of the correspondence. What is the gravity theory? What is the quantum field theory? And those are the situations where we really understand holography well, or best. And yeah, so the question is sort of, are there similar constructions from string theory that could be different space-time asymptotics, for example?
Yeah.
At present, there aren't, but there's mileage, we think, in trying to apply these sort of bottom-up methods to try and understand other asymptotics, such as decidual cosmological space-time for asymptotic flat at those times.
Mm-hmm.
But in all these cases, we don't really have a top-down construction from string theory, so we're not on such a secure, where we're on a much less secure footing. We're really trying to sort of work from bottom up.
Robert, you had a point?
Yeah, I'd like to come to what to the first point that you wrote on the board, but there's also a relation with the question that was asked by you. So the way that I see it is, and I may be completely wrong, the ABS-CFT correspondence is a duality between two effective field theories, each of which contains space-time, a classical space-time, one of them Minkowski space-time, the other one Agatha superspace, or maybe in your version, the superspace. So in what sense does ABS-CFT tell us anything about the quantum nature of space-time?
About the?
Quantum nature of space-time. So that's, again, I guess, a question to ask.
Yeah. Niyayesh?
So I just wanted to kind of maybe push that even further to make it even more heretical, that maybe holography or maybe holography or the safety doesn't tell us anything about the quantum nature of space-time. It's just basically it's a language, so it's a dictionary. You could be like a Spanish and English, or I don't know, French. So you have two different languages to describe the world, but you said you need a story to tell, right? And at the story, could it be a string theory, could it be the quantum gravity causal sets, and you could tell that story in two different languages, and this holography gives us a dictionary to basically translate the language from, translate the story from language to the other, but it's still a dictionary, it doesn't actually tell the story itself.
Lots of comments. Samir.
I just want to throw in a comment here for people who might not be that familiar with ABS-CFT. I mean, it was very something very difficult when it comes all the way down from string theory. But the actual primitive example of ABS-CFT, as Polyakov always likes to say, you know, as to Polyakov is one of the founders of ABS-CFT also. So the primary example which motivates this is the study of the matrix model. If we just take a matrix, but a big n by n matrix, then it has n eigenvalues. And if you do the path integral over all these possible matrices, so it's just, there's no space, just a matrix at one point, the eigenvalues want to spread out. And then this spread out eigenvalues, this is what's called the Das-Jevicki theory, they behave like a dimension of space. The eigenvalues don't want to come close, there's more, they want to repel each other. It's called eigenvalue repulsion. It's well known about the property of eigenvalues of a matrix. All the dynamics of the eigenvalues, if you squeeze them, they want to relax back, is exactly the dimension of the dynamics of 1 plus 1 gravity, you squeeze space, you want to relax back. So that's a simple, solvable model, completely solved, and it's a primitive example of ABS-CFT. You can see it's an exact map. I'm just trying to maybe give some background to all different questions which were asked about, is it exact, or which is more basic, which is emergent. But this is all there is to it, and everything else is a sort of more complete example of this. Just take lots of eigenvalues of a matrix, and just imagine laying them out on a line. And the way the eigenvalues to squeeze and go out is done for the space time. And everything else, all the ideas of ABS CFT are already there. It doesn't have anything to do with either ABS or any particular geometry. That's all there is to it. So, usually, what happens if you have large number of degrees of freedom in one dimension, you can write them in terms of less degrees of freedom in one more dimension. You just spread out the eigenvalues, and that's all you have.
Carlo.
I'd like to bring together things have been said and get to the question, as you put it initially, holography from fact to fictions. It seems pretty obvious to me it's neither a fact nor a fiction in the following sense. It's certainly a fact about some fields. I mean, there is some, and I'm not even sure convincingly demonstrated it's useful here for you, because it is a fact that there are certain relations between certain things you do on ADS and certain things you do in open theory. It is a fact that there are certain relations, I mean, between some matrix models and something. So this is a mathematical fact. Well, then there's an interesting question whether these are related to, useful for understanding our world or not. And this is a separate question. So it seems to me that there is around a hypothesis which is entertained by a lot of people, which, oh yes, this can tell us, this can be a feature, some version of this can be a feature of reality. And there are some pieces of elements here and there that people take as indications that, okay, that could be a feature of reality, that there is some sort of logic of this sort. Now, what I see dangerous and I dislike in the current situation is that there is very often a sliding between considering holography an hypothesis and considering holography something we can rely upon to draw consequences that we consider reasonable. And the quintessential example of this, and this is what I want to get at, seems to me the so-called information paradox of black holes, which if you carefully analyze why there is information paradox, I mean the page version of the information paradox, not the information paradox about what happens beyond the singularity or after the evaporation, but sort of half time before, at page time. There is no paradox whatsoever. There is no contradictions between generativity and quantum field theory whatsoever. There's no problem with unitarity whatsoever, unless you make some, you squeeze in some holographic assumption. So if you take holography as an hypothesis, so what I'm suggesting is that holography is an hypothesis. The hypothesis that as a consequence, for instance, create the black hole information paradox. But that's not the way things are presented around. The way things are commonly presented is that there is a paradox. Either this is wrong or this is wrong, because of course we think that there is something holographic. And that seems to me a mistake which is in the way things are often presented. So I would like to bring down the holography from a myth. It's not a myth, it's a good idea about how the world could be. Mm-hmm. But the world might also not be like that. Or a fact. It's not a fact. It's just it's a fact about certain mathematical relations to theories that might apply to the world or not. And that's a hypothetical part of it.
I just want to say I agree with the point you're making, but I want to clarify that I think many people view the paradox as interesting and fruitful as an internal paradox of the holographic viewpoint. Like, if you adopt holography, you seem to be able to reach opposite conclusions within the statements that are supposed to hold within holography. Therefore, to resolve it is to learn more about that hypothesis of holography. But you're totally right that many people speak more loosely and maybe even believe differently and sort of just assume holography is actually physically right. That's a different perspective on it. But I think if you listen closely, I would guess most people have the motivation that I described, that it's, you know, because holography seems so interesting and there are a lot of things going for it, it's important to understand its own internal paradoxes better.
Usually, if one makes an hypothesis to find a paradox, the first thing that one questions is the paradox, not the quantum field theory, generativity, unitarity.
Sorry, say that again?
I mean, if I have...
The hypothesis, you mean?
Hypothesis.
You question the hypothesis.
Yeah.
Right, but so
three
people...
in physics, things that we seem to agree upon as...
No, I understand your point.
I have another one and get a paradox. This weakens the paradox, usually. And it's somehow... We can say that's only the hypothesis.
The hypothesis, right. But if there's a way to resolve it within the hypothesis, then you learn much more deeply about how the thing you're hypothesizing about works. That's my personal motivation. I thought that's most people's motivation, but maybe not.
Well,
But there were other comments, and you need to tell me, Nyayesh, when we should end.
I think so. So just the consideration is that we have banquet at 5:30. It's probably good to 15-minute break. So I would suggest to wrap up in 5 minutes or so. Yeah.
Oh, okay, good. So there were several hands here. Rob.
Well, I'm in, like, I'm in a bit of agreement with Carlo. I don't think it's either fact or fiction. Maybe it is a dictionary, but we don't know what the story is. I mean, one of the problems I have with it in a more definite, what do I give for students kind of sense, it's very well defined, or at least it's best defined for EDS-5 and soup n equals 4 super Yang mills, but it seems to be a term that's bandied about in a rather broad way where I never really know what the CFT is except in that context. So it's not clear what to calculate, typically. Furthermore, I've been told by a number of people, not that it stopped me, but if something that is done in the bulk doesn't fit with holography, then what you're doing is wrong, which I think is utter nonsense. I live in a bulk, I don't live in a boundary, so I would take the viewpoint that if it doesn't work for ADS-CFT, that's their problem, not mine. For example, black hole thermodynamics with variable lambda, where people said you can't have variable lambda, it doesn't make any sense, wah, 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 wah. And what actually, recently, we have found a way of getting it to work in this. So so I think this is some of the problem with this, is it's a, like, to get back to this notion of what Chris said, the final theory, it's not clear, it's just not clear enough what it does. And I think what people do, because they want to get results, is they shut up and calculate, right? I mean, is that evil? Well, I don't know, but it's not what the promises were originally, right? It's partly what I was getting the question I asked Paul earlier. The whole idea was that weak gravity is strongly coupled CFT and vice versa. Oh, we could use this to learn about strong CFTs and weak gravity, but the promise really hasn't been delivered. I know people are going to say, Rob, Rob, entropy, viscosity. Rob, Rob, entanglement, entropy, Rutak, and Yagi. Yes, there are some results, but still, I think this is there. Am I being too harsh?
Are you asking me?
Anyway.
I think you're being a little too harsh, but Steve, yeah.
Comment on that. I mean, maybe be the devil's advocate here, but shut up and calculate was kind of the motto of quantum theory and quantum field theory for about 50 years, during which advanced quite a bit. And it advanced because people decided to ignore these questions about realism and what the ontology of the theory is. So I kind of wonder whether or not, and the question is that many of us are asking, including but not only the philosophers were relegated to, they were philosophical questions, and you couldn't make a case that it's not the physicist's responsibility to extract a unique ontology and tell you a story about space-time. It's the physicist's responsibility to calculate observables and match the data in the CMB. As I say, this is a sort of a devil's advocate thing, but there's an interesting parallel to the development of quantum theory.
I said it deliberately. Of course, in a year or two, ChatGPT will do it all for us.
Michael,
Carlo had another comment.
It would be, it's the detail. It would shut up and calculate the scattering amplitude of that particular quote that was measured the day after it served. Not shut up and calculate something which is published in a journal and then shut up and calculate something else. Mm-hmm. What difference? I mean, the shut up and calculate of the final time that you referred to was calculating things that were measured the day after at Fermi level and CERN.
It's observables versus like abstract.
There was an effort to calculate actual observables.
Okay, we've got a fresh comment in the back.
Can I just change the topic? There's a question on the blackboard. Can be quasi-local? You mean, I guess, that you have a system in which things are local and then you want the corresponding things in the dual theory to also be dual color. But so there's an interesting paper maybe for that question. It's called, I think, locality from spectrum, in which they show that almost always, if you have a spectrum of a Hamiltonian and it has a local representation, if you want to represent it in a different system, it's not going to be local. So your local representation is unique. So if that paper is valid in this scenario, then the answer would be
it's interesting.
Yeah.
Your paper has a little problem. Huh? It relies on the fact that you need to single out a fixed time. So you cannot work in a fully covariant framework in which you have to choose a clock and so on.
Yeah, I mean, holographic theories have this property that time in one is RG4 in another. So I don't know to which extent it applies, but I just wanted to mention this.
Thank you.
I have a question. If they're not local observable, what do we observe? What am I looking at?
Well, you're in a particular state. I mean, you're in a universe that's in a particular state. You're looking at what your eyes see.
Can the team describe this? All the measurements that we've done in the history of physics, all done on Earth, it's
yeah.
Not on Sky.
Yeah.
So isn't the theory supposed to describe these?
Yeah, that's what I thought. Robert raised the same question, and I thought I addressed it.
How about scattering amplitudes? They're also scattering amplitudes are also described. You come from infinity. It's of course not real infinity.
I agree, but what I'm saying is that physics is not only about scattering amplitudes. It's also about most of gravitational theory is not about scattering amplitudes. It's about the solar system, about how. There should be a way, and in general, in classical general relativity, every relativist knows how to write local observables in spy of the different variants. It's a bit tricky, everybody knows it's a bit tricky, everybody got confused but somehow, for 40 years, the relativists got confused, right? They didn't know about gravity, they didn't understand gravitational wave because of this problem, they didn't a beginning and understand. Rising because this problem of all sorts. But then, experimental relativistic gravity, it's a totally solid ground. We know exactly what we measure in classical general relativity. It seems to me that we're going to the same phase. It's more people coming to general relativity. They say, oh my God, there's different variants in the world that's unobservable. Well, this has been discussed for 40 years. And there's complete clarity about the fact that I sit within the solar system. I measure the distance of Venus in some concrete way. These are observable. These are diffeomorphic variant quantities.
Oh yeah, but again, they're relying on the particularities of the state that you find yourself in.
And what's wrong with it?
Well, they're not observables on the Hilbert space. They're not operators that you could define on the full Hilbert space of the theory.
So it looks like this is a discussion we can keep continuing maybe for the next couple of days, but I think we're kind of coming close to the end of the day. Let me thank everyone and then